The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern with Melissa Exelberth and Mark Garber this holiday weekend and encores of some notable recent segments to begin a final month of this program after more than 32 years on air. First, Ebola there and here, a survey of American preparedness to deal with that devastating African epidemic should it break out in our own country. Then, David to Goliath, an American rabbi's wife in Jerusalem on how the Gaza fighting has affected lives on both sides of the border, Israel's image and support. Followed by The Roots of Right, historian Rick Perlstein on his new book about the Nixon-Reagan connection and its role in the often too tangled politics of today. Then Alexandria by the Bay, a high-tech multimillionaire's project to archive everything published, posted, filmed, or broadcast, including our show. Finally, Romance and Dance, celebrating black and white cinema icons Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire and the songs they helped make immortal. For Your Ears Only, for the week of August 31st, Labor Day, and the start of our final month on air, much of it down memory lane, I'm David Alpern, now with Melissa Exelberth from our August 10th broadcast.
We think that the data are not as accurate as we would like. There may be cases counted as Ebola that are not, and there may well be many cases not counted that are. The lack of treatment facilities, the lack of laboratory facilities make it so that the data coming out, it's kind of a fog of war.
The company is trying to scale up on the production. It's difficult to produce these particular types of antibody cocktails, and it's not at the level of being able to mass produce.
The battle against an unprecedented epidemic of deadly Ebola virus declared a global emergency by the World Health Organization last week is hampered on multiple fronts. Inadequate public health services in affected countries hamper both treatment, such as it is with no proven cure, and reliable information about how the disease is spreading, as U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Tom Frieden testified on Capitol Hill. Distribution of an experimental drug being tried on a pair of American medical missionaries, now back at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, is limited by production difficulties, not to mention the normal need for testing safety and effectiveness over time, as noted by Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institutes of Health.
While U.S. officials repeat assurances that an Ebola epidemic here is not likely, it turns out that Emory is only one of four hospitals in the country with facilities best suited to deal with the disease. And most health facilities don't even have guidelines on how to prioritize the resources they do have in case of such an outbreak. Boston Globe reporter Deborah Kotz surveyed the domestic medical deficiency for a story last week. And for Your Ears Only, she joins us now to say more. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First, what are the most important facilities at Emory that made it the place to treat the two American missionaries, even before an experimental drug came in from San Diego?
It has a special infection control unit that is staffed by people who are specially trained in dealing with infection control with these kinds of deadly infectious diseases. So these patients came in, they were fully gowned, completely covered so that the patients themselves, you weren't able to touch them directly. They brought them into these very isolated rooms. When doctors went in to examine them, obviously they would be completely gowned up. And when they left the room, importantly, they would be able to disinfect anything that came out of that room. So they weren't bringing any of the germs outside the room. That was extremely important.
Even if a hospital had such resources, you say it could easily be overwhelmed by demand in an epidemic, especially if it had no firm guidelines on who should get the benefit of them.
Well, you know, it's a really great question, and they really don't have firm mandatory guidelines on the federal level that say this is who we should treat first. That said, the Institute of Medicine and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention both came up with these recommendations for, you know, looking at the flu epidemics. And so that is something we are familiar with as opposed to Ebola, and saying, you know, in the case of a deadly flu epidemic, how will you decide, for instance, if you have a limited supply of ventilators to keep people with an acute lung failure breathing, how do you decide which patients should get those ventilators? And what they recommended was that you should sort of be giving a priority to the people who are keeping society functioning, potential vaccine manufacturer. You might give it to police officers or the military force over women and children, for instance, and that's something that's seen as potentially controversial.
But experts you spoke with said some local doctors and hospital officials might find it hard to ignore those we generally think of first, pregnant women, children, the elderly.
Absolutely. And there's an argument to be made to be giving treatments to the sickest individuals or to people who are at risk for being the sickest. For instance, you know, in the H1N1 outbreak, pregnant women were getting far sicker when they were getting infected with the flu virus than the general population, and also potentially putting their baby's health at risk. So there was a priority to get pregnant women vaccinated. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is sort of done on the fly because you don't always know what you're dealing with. And that's why some ethicists were telling me that it's difficult to really set firm rules in place because every infectious disease outbreak is different.
An avian flu outbreak in 2006 led former Governor Mitt Romney to propose a special stockpile of resources. What was his plan and what happened to it?
He suggested and asked legislators in the state to appropriate $36.5 million to stockpile extra hospital beds, extra breathing machines, doses of medication like Tamiflu in the event that there was a flu outbreak. But his request was turned down by state legislators, and I don't think there are any requests in the pipeline or any plans in the pipeline to really implement this.
What do you think about calls to reduce testing time and expand the availability of experimental Ebola drugs? ZMAP from that firm in San Diego and AVI-7537 from Sarepta Therapeutics in Cambridge, not far from Boston.
Obviously, it's hard to argue with calls like that. You certainly want to get any potential treatments out there quickly into as many people as possible. The question is, it's not just a matter of financing, because I think there probably are folks who are willing to finance this, but it's a matter of, first of all, logistics. These drugs are grown on, at least ZMAP is grown in a tobacco plant, and that requires the plants, so you have to get tobacco manufacturers to provide those plants and the time to grow it. It's a complicated process. The other big question mark is just, you know, how safe and how effective are these drugs? They have not been tested widely in humans at all. I mean, basically only these two people, Americans, who are being treated now in Emory, have gotten this drug, and they seem to be doing better, but it's hard to say whether they're, you know, stabilized from the drug or from getting really good treatment. One big factor in Ebola, whether people survive Ebola or not, is how when the disease was caught, how good their treatment was, whether they were well nourished before they got this virus. So it's hard to say how it would do in a poor population in Africa.
And what about the questions we heard at the African Leaders Summit in Washington about why the experimental drugs that do exist are being kept for Americans back in America when the need is so much greater, where the epidemic is running out of control? Should there be an exception for that whole area?
I mean, I think that's a great question. I think it's, you know, there are a lot of questions as to, you know, why were these two American aid workers treated before other people, you know, residents in the population in these countries? And I think that, you know, part of it, as Dr. Anthony Fauci had said, that, you know, part of it is logistics. They were able to get these medications to these doctors. The doctors were in the hospitals. They were already being treated. They could transport it there. There was a sense that, you know, these are American companies and they would like to treat American patients first, and we can argue about the ethics of that. But I also saw some interesting ethical issues raised today as well, that they were saying that if they had given these experimental drugs to the African population and these drugs had failed miserably, then there may have been critics who were saying, you know, you're using us as guinea pigs. Why don't you test this in your American population before you test it in Africans? Why should we be your guinea pigs? And there's a lot of distrust of the medical system in African countries because, you know, rightly or wrongly so, a lot of Africans have not gotten great medical care, and there have been some forms of experimentation on these populations where they say, you know, do we really trust you to be giving us something that's experimental? And again, the question is this drug going to do more help than harm? I mean, if you give it to a mass population without actually knowing the safety risks, how do we know that we may not be killing more people? So it's an interesting ethical question. And when you have a disease that's so deadly as Ebola, you know, it's difficult to say why not, if you have any kind of promise of a hope of treatment when there is none, why not try this out in a widespread population?
Boston Globe health reporter Deborah Kotz from our August 10th broadcast. Within a week, there were reports that hospitals nationwide were hustling to upgrade resources for dealing with Ebola, but serious debate broke out over CDC guidance that full moon suit protection was not necessary. The World Health Organization decided experimental drugs could be administered more widely in West Africa, and ZMAP was given to three infected African doctors in Liberia. A Spanish priest who also got it later died.
Next, from David to Goliath over Gaza, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Mark Garber.
I'm David Alpern with a July 27th segment and this quote from the news. A comprehensive condemnation of the CIA, the Black Site program, and Poland's role in it. That was Joseph Margulies, lawyer for one of two terrorism suspects, after the European Court of Human Rights ruled against Poland for allowing their transfer to a secret CIA site for torture. It was the first such case of European complicity the court has taken up. Now this.
I don't know what happened. We were sleeping. Our house completely collapsed on us.
It's morally wrong to kill your own people. Whole world has been watching, is watching with great concern. You must stop fighting and enter into dialogue.
Sirens over Tel Aviv, the survivor of a bombing in Gaza, and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon after the attack on a UN school that killed at least 15 Palestinians sheltering there, many of them children. With the death toll among Palestinians approaching 1,000 compared with 35 Israelis, much of the media coverage began to suggest overkill on the part of Benjamin Netanyahu's government.
Rejecting the urgent plea from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry for a week-long humanitarian ceasefire, Jerusalem did announce a 12-hour lull during which it would continue its search-and-destroy campaign against Hamas tunnels into Israel. For an on-scene view of the situation for Your Ears Only, we turn to Dassey Berkowitz, an American Jewish educator and program director, recently relocated to Jerusalem with her husband, Rabbi Leon Morris, and three young children. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When did you and your family arrive in Israel?
So we arrived just a month ago, and it was right around the time that the three teenage boys were kidnapped, Naftali, Gilad, and Ayal. And things were tense here. When we arrived, a friend of mine commented that things are tense, please bring some joy. So we're very happy to do that. You know, this is a big change for our family and really a dream of ours to make the Jewish homeland our home. And so we were full of energy when we first arrived. And I think what we sensed immediately was really the solidarity among Israelis.
How has the conflict affected the lives of your husband, your children, and yourself?
So we've had three sirens in Jerusalem, and thank God for the Iron Dome missile defense system, which has been amazing at really defending against any major damage, certainly here in Jerusalem. You know, the South has been a little bit stronger hit, but we've, you know, one of the most startling of the sirens was on a Saturday afternoon, a Shabbat afternoon, when we were having a picnic lunch, and all of a sudden the siren went off, and we quickly took shelter in a neighboring apartment building. And what was amazing was, you know, a woman from the building who came and was at the door and saw us running with our children and beckoned us in, and we all kind of hung out in the shelter. All Israeli apartment buildings are built with miklatim or bomb shelters, because sadly this happens too often. But we try to normalize it as much as we can, you know, singing the Itsy Bitsy Spider calms tensions. And I think when you're a parent, you realize that when you have the responsibility for calming your kids, it enables you to really calm yourself.
You write about peace marches and joining gestures of Jewish-Arab unity, but also about the needs of the hour as Israel's armed forces target tunnels, the rocket arsenals, and launching capabilities of Hamas. Do you see this military goal being achieved on a permanent basis, or at least for a substantial period of time, or just in the cyclical way the conflict has surged and subsided for years?
You know, sadly, there is really a cycle of violence here, and you know, I was speaking to a rabbi here, Tamar Elad Applebaum, who says, you know, there's a cycle of violence, and then, but what we really need is visionary leadership and even regular civilians who can have faith and kind of jump beyond the cycle and see the bigger picture. So I think that, you know, I think this isn't going to end the conflict and the conflict in the Middle East. I would hate to say that it's a permanent one. You know, the faith side of me says that there will be peace one day, but I think it takes a lot of smart people to think creatively and to really dream big to make that happen.
You also write of the smart, talented, educated people of Gaza you met during a more hopeful period and wish they had produced the kind of Palestinian leadership that values state building and civil society. The suggestion seems to be that they could have created a firewall against Hamas extremism. But the critics say such leaders could not succeed because Israeli policies precluded the kind of economic and social development that might eventually have rallied the so-called Arab street.
So, you know, I think I would look back to 9 years ago when Israel evacuated Gaza and we left agricultural industry and other industries there. And, you know, our goal, you know, it's a small neighborhood. Our goal is really to have Gaza thrive socially, economically, politically, with a peaceful Gaza. Israel can thrive. You know, there could be a ton of commerce going back and forth. You know, this was Shimon Peres's dream of the Middle East and the new Middle East. So, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm not a pessimist. And I think that there certainly is a sense of radicalism that, you know, that has led to the popularity of Hamas. But I don't think that those are the only voices. You know, I think that there are plenty of people who want to live good, happy lives and provide for their children and their families and would be willing to do so. But they're shouted out by extremist elements.
Even some Jewish critics of the Netanyahu government say it has already lost the war for international public opinion. The number of fatal accidents, if that's what they really were, is growing daily. And the toll of civilian Palestinian dead and wounded is just so much greater than that on the Israeli side. Do you fear that the image of Israel as underdog David is morphing into that of a cruel giant Goliath?
You know, I think that public opinion, you know, I think the news and the media is so quick, you know, now, and pictures paint 1,000 words, 100%. But I think we really need to be attuned to nuance and listening and hearing. And if you're only hearing one story, to listen for more and more stories, I think, on both sides. I think the loss of life is tragic. But I also think that we need to remember that the Israeli army this isn't a war that they're looking for. The Israeli army has done what it can to try to get to warn civilians to evacuate their homes. So I think that we really need to be careful of what we're listening to and hearing. We need to remember that, you know, Israeli values are American values, due process, you know, certainly things go wrong in the IDF and not everything is, you know, picture perfect, and that those incidents are reported and they are evaluated and that there's, you know, due process, freedom of press, all of that. So I think that before we're so quick, of lambasting Israel for being the giant Goliath, I think we need to be more attuned. But, I mean, it pains me as a mother, you know, too, but there is so much loss of life. And we, you know, please God, pray for the end of this conflict and the ceasefire very soon.
Dazi Berkowitz is an American Jewish educator and program director, recently relocated to Jerusalem with her husband, Rabbi Leon Morris, and 3 young children.
From our July 27th broadcast, the Gaza death toll topped 2,000 after at least 10 ceasefires. Fewer than 100 of them were Israelis, mainly soldiers. More than 10,000 Gazans were reported injured, and the United Nations Human Rights Council formed a commission to investigate possible war crimes headed by William Shabas, a Canadian professor of international law. Though previously named to the Israel Law Review, he was painted as pro-Hamas by Jerusalem. Next, Nixon, Reagan, and Roots of the Right, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with a news quote from our August 10th broadcast. We're going to have to work with other people to get it done. That was a call for bipartisanship by Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander after becoming the latest mainstream Republican to beat back a Tea Party primary challenge. Similar moderate victories have been scored in Kansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, and South Carolina. Now this.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
In the eyes of many in the world, this every four-year ceremony we accept as normal is nothing less than a miracle.
Richard Nixon resigning, the only U.S. president to do so yet, and Ronald Reagan starting his first term in the office after riding and reinforcing a right-wing wave that continues to this day. The connection between that historic going and coming and the two tangled politics of our own time is traced in the third volume on American conservatism by historian Rick Perlstein, The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, new from Simon & Schuster. And to talk more about it, for your ears only, Perlstein is on the line again now. Welcome back to the program.
It's truly a pleasure.
Not coincidentally, we presume, publication of your new book was timed to the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation last week. But were you surprised that it also lands at a time that talk of presidential impeachment is again in the air, as well as conflict in the Middle East and charges of impropriety by U.S. secret intelligence services, CIA torture, and massive NSA snooping after the 9/11 terror attacks?
Well, certainly the impeachment thing didn't surprise me at all. I remember doing a radio interview with an NPR reporter who asked me what I expected from Obama's second term, and I said the Republicans will try to impeach him. And he was incredulous, and he said there's no way. But the fact of the matter is I've been writing since about 2007 that there are millions of Americans who don't consider Democrats in general and liberals in particular, legitimate kind of partners in the governing of the country. That sort of extremism is one of the things that I'm tracing in this three-book series of mine.
Your new book actually ends at the point Reagan has lost his first bid for the Republican presidential nomination to Gerald Ford, who as an appointed vice president became the incumbent after Nixon's resignation. But you see that loss helping to recharge the anger and determination of conservatives previously pummeled in the Lyndon Johnson landslide over Barry Goldwater. Talk about that.
Yes, very much so. That convention is very fascinating as a loss of a battle that suggests kind of soon to be the winning of a war. Basically, to take it back, Ronald Reagan decides he's going to run for president against a sitting member of his own party, which hasn't been successful since Chester Arthur. And Ford is, of course, weak politically. He has pardoned Nixon, which is very unpopular. He has never been elected. But still, the pundits are like, this is crazy. And when Ronald Reagan scored well in a Gallup poll early in 1976, one of the newspapers ran it under the headline, "Has the Gallup poll gone crazy?" But, you know, he battles to basically neck and neck with Ford. He uses the issue of the Panama Canal. America's renegotiating the treaty, and Reagan calls that a giveaway to a tin-horn dictator. And after Vietnam, this message he's giving, that his slogan was, "We bought it, we built it, it's ours," was that a kind of America was selling away its patrimony piece by piece. And that sort of patriotism was very compelling. Of course, Ford pulls it out in the end, but Ronald Reagan gives the final speech of the convention, and he's leaving the delegates in tears. And much like in 1964, where he gave a closing speech for Barry Goldwater in the last week of that election, he leaves Republicans saying, "Wow, maybe we chose the wrong nominee."
Well, a key part of Reagan's appeal, you say, even across party lines, was the honor and absolution he offered Americans after the shame of Watergate, defeat in Vietnam, and a variety of complaints about economic and social conditions. Say more on that.
I basically discovered, I don't think any other historian has really written about this, that Ronald Reagan's response to Watergate was always either to dismiss it, saying it wasn't an important story, or to say that, well, most famously, a quote that really kind of got a lot of attention at the time, the Watergate burglars were, quote unquote, not criminals at heart. Or sometimes you would even call Watergate a Democratic lynching, that the Democrats were trying to undo the results of the landslide of 1972, which, you know, kind of was nonsense because Watergate was this extraordinary movement of people from both parties coming together to investigate malfeasance, which was seen in, at least among the elite, as kind of universally reviled. But the idea that Ronald Reagan was saying these things was seen as kind of a total impediment to his political rise. And what people didn't understand at the time was this kind of permission he was giving to his listeners, to the American people, not to worry, not to kind of face this big structural problem. The kind of riffs he was doing about Vietnam in 1980, his most famous line about that was that the Vietnam War was in fact a noble cause, was very attractive to people who didn't really want to do the hard work of reckoning with the morass of the 1970s.
How do you explain the fact that Reagan is now such a hero to the rigid Republican right when his own conservative rhetoric was often contradicted by compromises he made to govern as president?
Well, it kind of, there's a parallel in how he ran for president in 1976. Gerald Ford, poor Gerald Ford, who was quite conservative, he got a zero from the liberal group Americans for Democratic Action when he was in Congress, was saddled with the responsibility of governing. And governing is not a profession for heroes. Right, so Ronald Reagan would always, you know, point to these compromises and say, "Look, we need a party that's represents no pale pastels." That was his line. And then, of course, when Ronald Reagan was in power, well, first as governor and then as president, he proved himself a very able compromiser, a very able manipulator of the process. But the fact of the matter is, Ronald Reagan was also very good, even when he lost in a compromise, to always kind of shore up rhetorically the idea that conservatives were right and liberals were wrong. He'd say he was forced into a compromise. Sometimes he would say he was forced into a compromise because his opposition was underhanded. He was always dividing the world into the good guys and the bad guys, such that conservatives, who, by the way, often reviled him for not only his compromises but his refusal to kind of staff his administration with conservative movement activists. I remember George Will writing very nasty things about Reagan when he talked to Gorbachev. Really, we're looking for a hero. And if you think about it, who else do they have? You know, there's Nixon, there's Ford, there's Eisenhower, who was seen as a centrist. There's a paucity of heroes to choose from. So kind of almost after the fact, much like Kennedy for the Democrats, he becomes this larger-than-life figure carved in marble for the future.
From our August 10th broadcast, Ron Perlstein's new book is The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan from Simon & Schuster. Next, Alexandria by the Bay, a library of all and for all, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern, now with Mark Garber in a July 20th segment, starting with this quote from the news. This figure seems to have magically fallen out of the sky today. That was Republican Jeff Miller, chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, rejecting the acting VA director's request for $17.6 billion over 3 years to solve the agency's waiting list problem. Now this.
I think we have the opportunity to one-up the Greeks. It's not easy to one-up the Greeks. But they, with the industriousness of the Egyptians, they were able to build the Library of Alexandria, the idea of a copy of every book of all the peoples of the world. The problem was, you actually had to go to Alexandria to go to it. I'm a librarian, and what I'm trying to do is bring all of the world's knowledge to as many people as want to read it. And the idea of using technology is perfect for us.
Brewster Kahle is hardly your run-of-the-mill librarian. An MIT-schooled computer engineer, later multimillionaire internet entrepreneur, Kahle is also a digital democracy activist, advocate of universal access to all knowledge, and creator of the free nonprofit Internet Archive based in San Francisco. Like the Great Library of Ancient Alexandria, it aims to make available on the web nearly everything written, recorded, or posted online, including, we're pleased and proud to say, all 32-plus years of this radio program and podcast. And to talk more about roots and progress of his digital Alexandria by the Bay, for your ears only, Brewster Kahle is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
Can you remember as a kid growing up in the 1960s what first got you interested in technology?
Oh, the computers were starting to become available, and you could get so much done. It was sort of the cool new whizzy thing. I guess it was sort of the internet of its era.
And what prompted you to think that so much human knowledge and creativity should and could be collected, preserved, and made searchable online?
By being a technologist and a kind of utopian or an idealist, there was this puzzle of what can you use technology for that you actually think worthwhile to do and spend a lot of time at it. And the idea of building the Library of Alexandria version 2 seemed like a really great idea. Then I started getting involved with artificial intelligence and finding that if we're going to build these computers to be smart, at least let's have them read all the books and be interesting entities to discuss things with. And that was just another motivator as time went along.
It started with books like Alexandria. So tell us how many you have stored, in what conditions, and why rather than discarding them after digitization.
We found that the libraries are starting to throw out books and throw out books at a velocity. They want to clear the space for people to use it with new and, you know, different uses than just stacks and stacks of books. So we started collecting the physical books, especially the books that we've digitized, if at all possible. We have a warehouse full of them now in this sort of physical archive, about 1.3 million books that are nicely put away. They're cataloged. We know exactly where they are. So the digital representation, which is the access version, knows where the physical version is, and the physical version knows what the identifier is for the digital version. And we just overfilled the warehouse, and we actually bought another warehouse, and now we're prepping it with all the temperature and containers and structures to go and be able to expand. We're trying to get to 10 million books, which would get us to a Boston Public Library or a Princeton or a Yale-class library physical collection.
When did you start broadening out to store films, broadcasts, web pages, and other information age content?
We started with the World Wide Web, and we started by trying to get publishers to put things online, gosh, in the early 1990s. And then by the time 95, 96, it was time to start really start collecting the web sincerely. So we started by archiving every web page from every website every 2 months to take a snapshot of the web every 2 months, and then we'd start again. We'd do it again and again and again, and it started to get big. We're now up to around 400 billion pages, and it's made available for free on archive.org in the Wayback Machine, so you can see past websites and see how they evolved and even things that have been taken offline.
I can see from what's being done with our old programs that beyond preserving and digitizing content, you analyze it and add the metadata, labels, or keywords that make it searchable by scholars and ordinary folks now and into the future. Is that done by human workers or by an algorithm that recognizes words and images?
We try to do as much algorithmically as possible, but of course not all of this can be done well by computers. They need to be guided by people. So for some collections, like our television collection in the United States, we have closed captions. So you can actually take the transcripts out of the program and go and make that searchable, kind of the way the Jon Stewart show does on The Daily Show. They basically search the transcripts to find the clips that they want to go and put in their show. And so by having television news up on archive.org, we try to make everyone into a Jon Stewart research department. We can do this with books as well. We can recognize the words pretty well, not always completely accurately, but actually going from speech to text, that technology we don't really have yet, and we're really trying to work with computer people to try to help integrate that into our systems, if at all possible. But until then, people do it.
And you say data you collect on visits to web content can tell us a lot about ourselves.
Yes. There's the Alexa Internet, which is a partner organization, keeps anonymized usage trails to be able to help understand how people use the web. And it's very interesting that people don't stay on spam sites. People are not dumb. I'm really quite heartened by how smart you can see people moving around on the net. They may spend some extra time on YouTube, but if it's junk, they're off of it in a nanosecond.
What's the price tag on your project so far and looking forward?
Well, just our organization costs about $12 million a year, and that most of that is for digitizing, either collecting web pages or collecting books, and then there's some of the other hard costs. But the cost of doing, say, the 10 million book project is about another $75 million to $100 million. And we're trying to figure out how to get that. It's such a bargain, but it's not written in anybody's budgets right now. So maybe it's going to be philanthropists Maybe it's going to be libraries learning that digital really should be pursued in an active way.
Brewster Kahle is founder of the Internet Archive at archive.org, now working on all 32-plus years of this program. Thanks for letting us into your library.
But when I try in here to tell you, dear, I love you madly, madly, Madam Librarian, Marion, it's a long-lost cause I can never win. For the civilized world accepts as unforgivable sin any talking out loud with any librarian, such as Marion.
Robert Preston from The Music Man. Now this quote from the news. A strong and clear case. That was an administration official on the grounds for extending by 4 months the six-nation talks with Iran over restricting and dismantling key parts of its nuclear program.
From our July 20th program. Next, Romance and Dance, Fred and Ginger. A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern with Mark Garber from our July 13th broadcast.
A fine romance with no kisses, a fine romance, my friend, this is.
You never give the orchids I send a glance. No, you like cactus plants. This is a fine romance.
Despite the ironic tone of that particular song by Dorothy Fields and Jerome Kern from the 1936 movie Swing Time, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers were Hollywood's great icons of fine romance, in song and dance, effortlessly synchronized, or so they made it seem, and glorious black and white as grateful audiences ground through gray days of the Great Depression.
The magical couple's songs and stories are celebrated by cabaret and concert veterans Steve Ross and Karen Oberlin this Thursday, July 17th, at the 54 Below Supper Club in Manhattan. It's called Cheek to Cheek, after the Berlin song Fred and Ginger introduced in 1935. And to talk more about it all, for your ears only, Steve and Karen join us again now. Welcome back to our show.
Astaire came to Hollywood from a well-established career on Broadway and shows that he did with his sister Adele, though she was the more famous. Tell us about that and his early roles before Ginger.
He had a very creative stage mother. There they were in Omaha. And she thought there was a life in Omaha, especially when she had on her hands her vivacious and very talented little daughter, Adele, and her somewhat more serious younger brother, Fred. So like the song in Chorus Line, I Can Do That, Fred goes along to the dancing lessons and soon realizes that he can do it too, and he wants to be part of the limelight, and he even sets up a little dance that he stages for her and him in little wedding outfits. And he was already staging and putting things together, and they became quickly a very popular kiddie act in the vaudeville days of the teens. Well, they started off and before then, but throughout the teens. And then when they, George Gershwin put them in a musical called Lady Be Good. This is the musical that put them and George on the map.
And Karen, tell us what Ginger was up to before the films with Fred.
Similar beginning. She was on tour as a kid. Ginger and the Redheads toured around. She had a few opportunities from being on the road. Had a mother also who was very invested in her daughter's livelihood and career. And she toured until she ended up also on Broadway, also becoming a star after a few other Broadway shows due to a Gershwin Broadway musical called Girl Crazy that also made a star of Ethel Merman. And one of the paid choreographers on that Broadway show, Girl Crazy, was none other than Fred Astaire. And then she went out to Hollywood and started making films before Fred did. She was a little bit ahead of him, and made a film, a Busby Berkeley film called Gold Diggers of 1933 that really sort of put her on the film map.
Steve, what do we know about how Rogers and Astaire were first teamed up for a film?
Their first one, we actually do a number from that. Their first appearance on the screen was in Flying Dunderier, and I guess the producer thought,
well, here we have these two bright young things. Let's see how they go together. And the rest, as they say, is all kinds of magical histories.
And I think Fred was a little frustrated with his partners, or so say some. And he, I've read that he said, well, what about Ginger Rogers? Because she was around and popular, and he wanted to see how she would do. And, of course, they just brought out the best in each other.
It said that he gave her class and she gave him sex.
That's what they say.
A broad statement, but you can see that. I think any partnership that's good and complementary would have something like that happen.
It's said that on screen Ginger did everything Fred did and backwards in high heels. But my favorite is when they danced side by side and she wore riding boots to Irving Berlin's Isn't That a Lovely Day to Be Caught in the Rain. Karen, do you have a favorite or two among all the numbers they did together?
I do have a favorite, and I actually mention it in the show, so I hope people still come, even though we give it away now. But my favorite is I'll Be Hard to Handle in Roberta. Mm. Where they have this dialogue. She sings it in a funny way, and it's just a wonderful, unique song. And they have an argument in dance where she ends up actually slapping him and stepping on his foot, and then they sort of make up in dance.
And Steve, what's your favorite?
Well, the show, I always term it the most elegant love song, I think, ever, one of them at least ever written, is The Way You Look Tonight. And the love songs are hard to do because you want to come at them from another way. You'd be so easy to love, isn't it? A similar example to that. But the way you look tonight is obviously what a swain would say to a girl, and boy, does he ever say it beautifully.
From our July 13th broadcast, following their celebration of Fred and Ginger, Steve Ross and Karen Oberlin unite for the 25th Annual Cabaret Convention, October 20th through the 23rd, in the Rose Room, Jazz at Lincoln Center, Broadway and 60th Street in New York. Steve joins the tribute to singing piano players like himself. Karen helps salute songwriter Irving Berlin. Another night features songs from Finian's Rainbow and other collaborations of Burton Lane and Yip Harburg, and there's a 90th birthday celebration for Broadway and cabaret legend Julie Wilson.
Our homeward step was just as light as the tap dancing feet of a stair.
I seem to find the happiness I seek.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, Stitcher.com, and going back years now at archive.org. This broadcast of Encores was engineered by Chad Dugatz and Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio, Play It Productions. For co-hosts Melissa Exelberth and Mark Garber, I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com. Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. This week last year, we considered the 50th anniversary celebration of the 1963 March on Washington and Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech there from our September 1st, 2013 broadcast hosted by Melissa Exelberth and me.
Sometimes I hear people saying nothing has changed, but for someone to grow up the way I grew up in the cotton fields of Alabama, to not be serving in the United States Congress makes me want to tell them, come and walk in my shoes. But we still have a great distance to go before we fulfill the dream of Martin Luther King Jr.
Everyone who realizes what those glorious patriots knew on that day, the change does not come from Washington, but to Washington. The change has always been built on our willingness, we, the people, to take on the mantle of citizenship. You are marching.
Georgia's Democratic Congressman John Lewis, last living speaker at the 1963 March on Washington, was still passionate at last week's 50th anniversary, both about the progress in civil rights and the challenges that remain. As the nation's first African-American president, Barack Obama was both a symbol of that progress and that challenge, as his approval rating remained stuck in the mid-40s and major initiatives he has supported remain blocked, like gun control, challenged, like immigration reform, or vulnerable to internal problems and rearguard Republican defunding, like Obamacare.
Obama promised to do what he could through executive action, but he also called on Americans outside Washington to help bring the change he had promised in two stunningly successful presidential campaigns. It was almost as if he had read an essay on lessons from the 63 March posted online a day earlier by our frequent guest Julian Zelizer, Princeton professor of history and public affairs, whose books include Arsenal of Democracy and Governing America. And to say more about that march, those lessons, and last week's proceedings, Professor Zelizer is on the line again for your ears only. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Obama said no one could match the oratory of Dr. King, but his own remarks had their moments, though some conservatives called them too partisan. What did you think?
Well, there were moments, clearly, including the president's own address. But overall, just having Barack Obama as the president leading the nation at this event is in itself something that is probably as powerful as Martin Luther King's speech. It is the fulfillment of at least part of the dream.
Well, of course, it should be noted that no conservative congressional Republican leaders accepted formal invitations to attend the proceedings at all. Does that undermine the party's recent efforts to better reach African Americans and other minorities?
You know, when the original Civil Rights Bill passed in 64, Martin Luther King, Lyndon Johnson, they were all insistent that it was bipartisan. They were all insistent, as Johnson said, that it was an American bill and not a Democratic bill. And I think Republicans would have done well to be part of this event.
Let's step back and consider some similarities and differences in the challenges facing Dr. King's dream 50 years ago and today. Back then, you remind us, the problem was centered not in the House but the Senate, and less the result of partisan polarization than internal party divisions. Talk about that.
Yeah, the main challenge to the Civil Rights Bill within Congress was that Southern Democrats didn't agree with Northern Democrats, and Southern Democrats controlled most of the committees in both the House and Senate. They were willing to use the filibuster as long as necessary to stop civil rights bills from passing, and they had been the main obstacles to this legislation. And ultimately, what saved the bill in Congress was that Senator Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader, joins Johnson and delivers the Republican votes that are necessary for this to pass. So Congress was divided and broken. It was just broken in a different way.
To what degree was the 63 March a beneficiary of popular outrage over earlier violence against civil rights activists in the South, which was carried nationwide by the then new medium of television?
Well, in some ways, it was a culmination of a movement that helped create that popular outrage. It was almost the reverse. The movement had been fighting at the local level in the South to engage in events that revealed to America what was going on and what racial segregation really meant. And so the march comes after the protests in Birmingham, where people saw children getting brutally beaten by the police. And this was the final step, in some ways, of that stage of the protest, and the goal was to put a lot of pressure on Congress to pass this bill and to deal with other issues such as economic justice.
Well, leaders of last week's proceedings kept reminding Americans that the 63 March was not planned primarily as a platform for Dr. King's dream of racial tolerance, but as a call for jobs and economic opportunity. And some see even greater economic inequality today as a near financial collapse leaves the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. How do you see it?
Well, some people have been critical of President Obama on this front as well, both his policies and the speech, and that it's true that a large part of the march wasn't simply about the civil rights bill. It was also about economic equality and doing what was necessary with policy to alleviate poverty among African Americans. Inequality has become worse. Residential segregation is also very bad. And there's all kinds of areas that the government will need to address if we're really going to have racial equality. That said, we shouldn't forget the achievements from that period. There isn't the kind of open segregation that we saw in that period. Voting rights are still entrenched in ways that will be impossible to reverse. And that was an important and, I think, relevant part of Obama's message.
To what degree is progress by marches and media campaigns more difficult today because opposition to progressive reforms has moved to the House, where so many Republicans have safe seats in conservative districts where their greatest fear is being considered not conservative enough?
Well, that does add difficulty. And back in the 1963-64 period, civil rights activists were very determined to protest not just in liberal areas of the country, but conservative parts of the country, including Midwestern states where there weren't heavy numbers of African Americans, but where they wanted to pressure Republicans into supporting these bills.
There's criticism of Republican leaders, but I wonder if reforms to reduce costly pork barrel projects and partisan government hiring at every level also reduce the power of party leaders to enforce discipline and the necessary compromise.
Well, that is true, and we have these structural changes that we have discussed in the way politics works, party polarization, the loss of earmarks as a tool for party leaders to negotiate, that removes some of the very tools that people like a Senator Everett Dirksen relied on. But again, back then, if you read the writing about Congress, it's remarkable to see just how broken it was believed to be and just how weak legislators were believed to be. And then, boom, you had an outburst of legislation like the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And part of that had to do with the grassroots. It had to do with the protests.
Thank you, Professor. Julian Zelizer is Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs and author of books including Arsenal of Democracy and Governing America.
Lessons of the March from our September 1st, 2013 broadcast. The country's progress and remaining problems have clearly continued, most recently with its first black president urging calm and justice after a member of the nearly all-white police force in largely black Ferguson, Missouri, fatally shot an unarmed black teen, prompting predictable citizen protests, nightly violence, and military-style pushback. It, quote, looked like it was in Baghdad, a shame and a disgrace, said black Congressman John Lewis, last surviving speaker at the 1964 march. He asked President Obama to declare martial law. Underlying today's racial tensions are growing economic disparities. The income gap between whites and blacks continued to widen, with median white household earnings at $67,000 in 2012, compared with about $40,000 for black households, according to the Pew Research Institute. Whites also suffered less from unemployment, poverty, and discrimination. You found that only 10% of whites said they had ever felt discriminated against due to their race, compared to 35% of blacks. I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, a classic version of that civil rights anthem we just heard the end of by the late, great Pete Seeger.
And then we'll see this song come true. We shall. Thank you.
in peace.
We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace. We shall live in peace.
We shall.